From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The Bush administration this week announced its intention to encourage single-sex public schools. The U.S. Department of Education wants to change the way the federal government enforces the 30-year-old Title IX statute that outlaws discrimination based on gender. Current law only allows federal funds to be used for single-sex public schools and classes if comparable educational opportunities are available to both boys and girls. The new proposal would give school districts more flexibility to achieve that goal. Proponents of single-sex schools give it an A+. Critics say it smacks of discrimination. What do you think? Do boys and girls learn better in separate classrooms or together? Does the notion of separate but equal bring back memories of old-time segregation? And with so many urban schools in shambles, is it time to put ideology aside and just try something new? Try single-sex schools. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Seattle is Benjamin Wright. He's principal of the Thurgood Marshall Elementary School. Last year, he set up a pilot program that separated boys and girls. Good evening and welcome, Benjamin Wright.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Also with us from the studios of WRNI in Providence is tonight's news analyst, Lewis Gordon, director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Good evening. Welcome, Lewis Gordon.
Good evening, Tom.
Benjamin Wright. So the Bush administration is looking at pushing single-sex schools across the country, opening that option for many more communities. What's your reaction?
I think it is really a creative and innovative but a bold step that probably should have been taken 10 years ago. I believe that we have pushed back many affirmative action programs. I think that the studies that we did some 30 years ago in terms of where girls was being left behind, and I think that Title IX probably was more appropriate at the collegiate level in terms of athletic and research and all those kind of things. But I think that the inner city, I believe, truly was left out of that research. I don't think it was included. And I know we're experiencing some very difficult times in urban school settings. I have found that the boys and girls, once they're separated, they have not only the opportunity, but they are easily influenced to concentrate on academics because that's all that's in front of them.
Well, we want to learn more about your story, Principal Wright. You're a principal at a public elementary school in Seattle. Describe for us what was going on between boys and girls when you arrived there 3 years ago. What were the key issues? How was the school doing?
When I arrived here, the primary issue was academic achievement, as it is throughout most of the schools that are considered low-performing schools here in Seattle. My job was to transform that to a high-achieving school. So when I came, I had to assess everything about the school. I had already looked at the data in terms of academics. I had looked at the data in terms of discipline. There's some disproportionalities there. And when I got here, when I arrived here, one of the things I noticed right away is that every day 30 kids came into the office for discipline reason, at least that many. And one of the problems with that was it was usually the same for the same reason. The hip-hop words that was being used in the hip-hop records had transferred to the playground. Boys was calling girls the B-words and the H-words, and girls was calling boys the P-words and the F-words, and they was getting into shoving matches. Teachers couldn't teach in their classroom because they spent an awful lot of time correcting kids, trying to get kids to speak correctly, trying to make kids be kind to each other. So one of the things that we talked about when I got here was having a school-wide behavior plan, not a discipline plan, but a behavior plan.
And how did you come to the conclusion, Benjamin Wright, that it was the gender conflict that was at the heart of these problems?
But Tom, what I did was I separated the referrals, and I looked at them.
These are the discipline problems that came to your office.
Right. I separated them, and I looked at them. And I analyzed what was being written on them by the teacher. And then when I brought the kids in, they confirmed what the teacher would say, that these kids live in the same neighborhood. This probably started before they got here. This little boy's been teasing this little girl for some time. And the little girl's been teasing him back. And then when they get in the classroom, they have to show off to the other friends that they still can put each other down. So after I got those and tried to deal with it in a co-ed setting, it would only go away for a couple of days, then would come back again. So with that in mind, we already had small group instructions, and that was not changing it as fast as we wanted it to change. The small group instructions had been here 5 years before I got here. So we decided that was not changing the process. That was not changing the problem. Kids still was low achievers.
So you decided to jump in and separate boys and girls, separate the genders in a pilot program. You started small with the fourth grade. Talk about what you did.
In the fourth grade, we had two new teachers. And there's always a new teacher that you can sort of talk into doing these things, I guess. But we had two new teachers who had just come into the school. One of them was a math specialist, because when I came, I wanted to make sure that I had teachers who could really help us with the subject matters. So, and I approached her. She was not even supposed to have a class. She was supposed to teach every class in the building. So I approached her and asked her, would she take a fourth grade all-boys class just to try something on a pilot basis, because I really wanted to solve these discipline problems. She said, well, okay, I've never tried it, but I'll do it. I approached another new teacher who had been teaching first grade and asked her, would she take the girls? And she said, well, if you ask me to, I guess I will.
And how did it work out?
It blew us away. The first day that the school started with those kids in those classes, I got not one referral. I didn't receive a one. Not two or three, but not one. The third week, the fourth week, the fifth week, nothing happened.
That is no discipline problems.
None whatsoever from those two classes. We've now started getting discipline problems from the first grade. They have any from the fourth grade. So I began to go into those classes quite often, and I asked other people to go in. We talked to the parents. We talked to the other teachers in the building. Of course, one of them told me that Thurgood Marshall was going to roll over in his grave. And I explained to him that this was probably what Thurgood would be doing this time if he was still alive.
What do you think it was about having the boys with boys and girls with girls that settled the kids down?
It started with the first teacher who told the boys that she had high expectations for boys and that they were her boys and that they were representing her whenever they went out of the room, so she did not expect them to fight. She didn't expect them to violate the school rules.
But couldn't she say that to boys and girls at the same time?
She probably could, but would they all listen because they're too busy showing off of each other?
Okay.
And could she get their attention? I don't think so. She spent the first 3 weeks of school just walking the boys through what she expected. So did the female that was teaching the girls. They spent the first 3 weeks of school talking about how young ladies act, how young men interact with young ladies. So it was a total process. But what was amazing is that because of the amount of time the kids were not spending in the office, they spent that time on an academic focus.
And the results?
And the results were amazing, too. Our boys scored the year before when I first got here, my first year on the walls of the Washington Assessment of Student Learning. Okay. Our boys scored in the 10 and 12 and 20 percentile. That's what our boys did my first year.
Roughly.
Our girls scored in the 30s and 40s. That year we separated them in listening skill alone. The boys scored 73%. In reading, they scored 67%. In writing, they scored 53%. In math, they scored 27%. They had never scored in math. So,
wow, that's a huge improvement. And the girls?
The girls stayed stable.
They kept their stronger scores.
They were at 47 in 50s and 40s. They was right around there, and that's where they stayed.
But they ended below the – they had been higher than the boys, and they ended up below the boys.
That's what happened.
What do you make of that?
I think that the difference was, in this case, was the approach that the two teachers took. One teacher – the teacher that had the boys.
You've got a school going on.
To 4:30. The one teacher that had the boys decided that she was going to make it a point that the boys would score higher in writing than the girls. And because she said the boys never would write, when she'd given them assignment, they would be real sloppy about it. And mediocrity breeds mediocrity. So she didn't want that. So what she did is she made them write every day.
How do you respond, Principal Wright, to critics who say that single-sex schools are discriminatory, even racist, perhaps sexist?
Well, I have to remind them that one of the things they need to look at is that we didn't get to Title IX by doing any kind of concrete research. We did that based on a couple of studies that people did, and then we blew those studies up. And we didn't do that by looking at what was going on with inner-city kids. We didn't do that by looking at what was happening with African-American kids. And I have a high population of African-American kids. And is it racist to make sure that no child get left behind? Well, then so be it. If it's discriminatory that no child get left behind, then so be it. What I'm looking at today is that we need to take the adult issue out of education. We really do. If we're truly going to educate every child, it's okay to have all these different ideology. I know that the American Association of University Women has concerns about it. I know the ACLU will have concerns. I know that NOW has concerns. I know all these different people have concerns. But the same problem persists. I'm losing boys to the streets every day to the gang in the inner city because I can't educate them. I'm losing girls to early pregnancy. I'm losing them to prostitution. I'm losing them to drug use. But I guarantee you, the single-sex classes in my school, we're able to talk about issues that we're never able to talk about in a co-ed setting. And it's time for us to be real about that. It's time for us to realize that we have to do this in order to repair the damage that we have done to these kids. Mm. And the hip-hop culture is not going away. And so that's okay.
It sounds like you've found your compass setting, and it's all about separating sexes. Benjamin Wright, we know you've got a school to run. Thanks so much for joining us for a few minutes.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Tom.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Lewis Gordon, there it is, a principal who has separated boys and girls and loves the results. What do you think?
Well, for one thing, many of the hip-hop folks are very sensitive, no doubt. They're going to have their response. But he's speaking about an issue of exigency. One of the difficulties we have when we set up rules is we often set up rules in society without looking at the context in which they're formed. And right now, what Principal Wright was referring to is a very pragmatic question, which is, to what extent do we have a system that will guarantee a certain level of performance? Now, his argument, it seems to me, is not the argument of separate but equal. His argument seems to be pushing the position of separate but better. In other words, his claim is that there's something that needs to be achieved beyond the question of equality, especially in the context in which he is trying to develop education for each of the students involved. Now, there are other issues that come out in his discussion that we have to consider. It wasn't mentioned there, but
okay. You
may notice that he kept bringing up hip-hop culture. One of the things in hip-hop culture at the moment is a heavy sexual element to it.
And here he's talking about the music, the lyrics that are so explicit.
And so forth, yeah. And then we have to couple this with something, what's very telling here, he's talking about an elementary school. Now, we've seen in other contexts where we're talking about the changes that are happening in girls and boys in the United States. Children are achieving puberty at earlier ages. Mm-hmm. So we have to bear in mind that we have to ask a basic question. Why didn't we have so much of an issue about co-ed education in the past that functioned in the way he's describing today?
10 or 20 years ago.
And one argument, you know, the studies have to be made there, but one argument could be that the children around that age group are very, in physiological terms, very different.
So we've got real changes maybe going on.
We have real changes, and it's bad enough if you're around 13 or 14 dealing with issues of sexuality and puberty, but the reality if you're 9 or in some cases 8-year-olds.
It's a lot to deal with.
And the adult content that's around them. One issue we have to deal with and take very seriously is that the context in which education is occurring, I would say not only in the urban settings because of the fact that some of these issues may be just available everywhere. That these kind of struggles may raise new questions in this stage of dealing with co-ed education.
We're going to look across the spectrum. I want to welcome into our conversation Rosemary Solomon. She's law professor at St. John's University and author of the forthcoming book, Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling. Good evening and welcome, Rosemary Solomon.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. You heard Benjamin Wright talk about his experience in Seattle. You've been thinking and writing about single-sex school. Does the success that Principal Wright describes in his school surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. The problem is, in this country, for the past 30 years, I'd say, single-sex schools has been considered legally off-limits because of certain impediments placed in the law, particularly in Title IX, and the way the federal government was enforcing that law.
But it wasn't just a legal issue, was it? Didn't people believe that boys and girls could and should learn together? That would guarantee equal education?
That's right, and it really comes out of very understandable concerns of the women's movement from the 1960s and 1970s, the belief that men and women are essentially equal and essentially the same, and that push for equal access to education and positions of power and prestige for women. And we can all understand that given the historical discrimination of against women in our society. But we have to really rethink that. Women have made enormous gains in the past 3 decades. Of course, I'm not suggesting that all the battles have been won, but we have made enormous gains, and we really have to reconsider education in the context of what we know about gender, what we know about child development.
Rosemary Solomon, hang on. We're going to consider a lot of that this hour. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about single-sex schools. The Bush administration is ready to push them. Should the federal government be clearing the way for single-sex schools? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new push by the Bush administration to clear the way for single-sex public schools. Boys studying with boys, girls studying with girls. We've heard this hour from a principal in Seattle who said he's tried it and it works, and many other people are saying the same thing, especially, interestingly, in inner-city areas. We're joined at the moment by Rosemarie Salamone. She's law professor at St. John's University and author of a forthcoming book, Same Different Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling, and by our news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon. He's director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Question is separating boys and girls somehow the magic bullet for better education? Do you believe young men and young women will get a better education if they get a separate education? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rosemarie Salamone, make the case for us. We heard one principal's experience there, but of course, you know, in a single experience, there can be a lot of factors that intervene. You're looking at this across the board. What's the case for single-sex schools?
Well, there are a number of issues involved. The issues for disadvantaged minority students are the most compelling.
Why is that?
Well, you have boys finding their self-esteem in sports and social popularity and really disidentifying with academic culture, that it's just not it's not acceptable in that subculture for males to be academically strong.
And all you have to do is take girls out of the picture and that changes? Can that really be true?
Well, no, but across the country where there have been attempts by school districts to set up single-sex classes for boys, what they've done is actually use male role models in the classroom, provide a very positive male role model for students, a male experience that boys can identify with, and to really, what these schools really do is they place the intellectual above the social. And again, that's especially important in poor, disadvantaged minority communities. For minority girls, very often they're finding their self-esteem and validation in early motherhood, as Mr. Wright was saying. That's absolutely true. But there are several single-sex schools for girls around the country that have held their ground over the years. And if you go into the Philadelphia High School for Girls and Baltimore's Western High School and the newer school in East Harlem in New York City, you will see schools that have achieved marvelous, phenomenal results with girls.
Well, you're raising a lot of interesting issues here, and I'm still fascinated by this focus of single-sex schooling on inner-city schools. But you've asserted here that if you put the boys in their own school, they're going to have better role models. I'm not sure why that should be the case. And that girls, well, there's still going to be boys around. I mean, teenage pregnancy, you know, we don't necessarily see the end of it just because they go to school in a different place for 7 hours a day, do we?
Well, but the truth is that students can find their self-esteem and their self-confidence in something other than what they're seeking it from now. They're going to find it in academic achievement, and that's really what these schools are doing. Single-sex schooling by itself is not—it's not a silver bullet by any stretch of the imagination. It's not going to solve all the ills of urban schools. But if you have a single-sex school that provides a rigorous academic program, the combination between the two seems to be a winning combination when you look at the schools that are operating now.
Is there persuasive evidence in terms of test scores at more schools than just Mr. Wright's?
Well, we don't have a lot of evidence coming from the United States because these schools just haven't been permitted to exist, as I said. We do have evidence coming from other countries, from Australia and from the United Kingdom, where single-sex education has been more the norm over the years than in the United States. And there is some evidence that both boys and girls do reach higher levels of achievement in single-sex schools as compared to comparable populations in co-ed schools. We do see a lot of anecdotal evidence coming from single-sex classes in the United States that girls in particular feel more comfortable in all math and science classes, that they're more likely to ask questions, to take a risk in class, and to enroll in more advanced courses once they've been in a single-sex class. And there's some evidence that they carry that self-confidence and self-esteem over into other classes that are not related to math and science.
And what about the old concern over separate but equal being impossible? Do you have any concern that one gender or the other may be advantaged or disadvantaged if we begin to separate students by sex?
Well, trying to draw an analogy between sex and race, that's a very flawed analogy. And I know many of those who oppose single-sex schools do it, and they do it very passionately. But You know, when the Supreme Court struck down racial segregation in the public schools back in 1954, that was in a system that was mandated by law, and it was intended to deny African-American children equal opportunity. What we see in the current single-sex initiatives is just the opposite. It's the opposite intent. It's the opposite effect. They're designed to empower students, to really help them realize their full potential.
Leave race aside. You're confident that over time, if the sexes are separated in schooling, that neither gender will be disadvantaged.
Well, you know, it really depends. This is single-sex education is not for every child. And what those of us who support it are saying is it's for some children, and we should really look at children as individuals. Co-education is always going to be the norm in this country, and rightly so. But there are some children and some teenagers who could just flourish more effectively academically and socially if they're separated from the other sex, not necessarily for 12 years of schooling, but just for a particular point in time. It could be that young boys might benefit more from single-sex schooling at the lower grades. We know boys enter kindergarten without the same level of verbal skills and fine motor skills that girls do. They're more active, they're more physical, they have a shorter attention span, and we expect boys to function at the same level of girls from kindergarten on. Well, it could be that young boys might benefit from being separated from girls at a younger age.
I want to put this to Lewis Gordon. Lewis Gordon, you're all wrapped up in Africana studies. How do you feel about this drive for single-sex schools being apparently quite overtly aimed at inner-city schools? Good, bad, indifferent?
Well, it connects to many issues. One of the problems is when we say inner-city, we often immediately think of race. But it was rightly pointed out by Professor Solomon. That some of the comparisons with race and gender often tend to be flawed. Mm-hmm. One complicated thing about how we deal with political issues in by the end of the 20th century into the present is that quite often when we're dealing with issues of social justice, we tend to racialize them to the point where many groups also become racial metaphors. But there is a dimension of this issue when we do bring up inner cities that I find particularly striking, and that is the class dimension of it. And what I mean by this is In terms of those in higher classes, the middle class and up, there are greater options in the society by virtue of having access to private education.
Where they could be single-sex if they wanted to.
In many ways, it seems to be, if we're going to make the case that those who depend on, don't have the option of private education, depend on public education, if they're going to, in the end, be competing in the world with those who have access to private education, it seems to be the case that if we're going to deal with the question of equality, they should at least have the options to the resources that those in a higher class stratum have.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying bring on the options. I want to bring into our conversation now Wendy Kaminer. She's a senior correspondent at the American Prospect. And I think, Wendy Kaminer, that you oppose using public money for single-sex schools. Is that right?
Yes, I do. And I think that the burden of proving that these schools are necessary, not just occasionally beneficial to some children, but necessary, the burden of proving that is on the proponents of it, because non-discrimination is our norm, or at least it is supposed to be our norm. I'm also skeptical of sex-segregated schools, because I know from experience and from study that conventional wisdom about sex segregation, it tends to be based on prejudices and preconceptions about essential differences between the sexes, about the male and female learning styles, for example. And it's worth noting that when VMI, the Virginia Military Institution, mm-hmm. was fighting the drive to allow to admit women, it used
case.
The same arguments in defense of male education that the proponents of single-sex education use in favor of all-female education.
Our boys will learn more effectively on their own.
Well, that boys and girls have different learning styles, and that sex-segregated environments are, you know, have benefits for both sexes, and usually people are talking in terms of stereotypes. Now, it may well be true that in some co-ed classrooms, boys dominate, especially in math and science. And if that's true, it seems to me me that the solution is not to take the girls out and put them in a special school. The solution is to make sure that you have good teachers who don't allow the boys to dominate, who control their classrooms the way good teachers are supposed to.
Wendy Cameron, let me ask you a question here that I think will come up. I think the National Organization of Women is stood up and said that they're against this, and I'm sure this will come up. You've written that a return to separate single-sex schools may hasten the revival of separate gender roles, and that separate gender roles have always been the basis for inequality between males and females. If it emerged that, in fact, kids could get better scores in separate classrooms, but they did indeed move towards separate gender roles, how do you weigh these two interests, one against the other?
I learned in law school never to answer an impossible hypothetical.
I think, is it impossible?
You know, I think it is highly unlikely that you would get both better educational results for males and females consistently and a return to traditional gender roles. I don't think those two things would go together, but I also don't think that you will find consistently better educational results from sex segregation, because mm-hmm. though this is often well-intended, it is also often based on stereotypes about how males and females behave, and it often encourages people to believe in stereotypes about their own behavior. I say this as a product of a single-sex college. It was a very sexist place.
You went to Smith College.
I went to Smith College, and it was probably the most sexist environment that I have ever been in, because males and females didn't interact collegially. They didn't meet as friends. They only met each other as sex objects and potential dates. I thought that was a very sexist environment.
And if that were writ large in the country?
Is that in, I don't quite understand.
Well, single-sex schools became much more common, you're saying this would be reproduced across the country?
Well, I don't think there's much chance of single-sex schools becoming much more common. If you look at, for example, where high school seniors choose to go to college, a very tiny percentage, something like 2% of them, will apply to single-sex schools. They want to be in co-ed environments. If you're talking about, I mean, we should separate out a couple of things. Mm-hmm. I think that having sex-segregated classrooms in a co-ed school is a very different proposition from having completely segregated schools. And I think it is easier to make an argument for having an occasional segregated classroom within an integrated school than it is to make the argument for having different school systems.
Let me put that to Rosemary Solomon. How about it? What if we just had an occasional class apart, Rosemary? Would that be as effective, to your mind, as actually having single-sex schools?
Well, it all depends on what population and what individual students you're talking about. For some students, that could be most effective. That could be exactly what they need. And we do see some very strong anecdotal evidence coming from this country supporting single-sex schools, not just for girls, but for boys. We know that many boys tend to shy away from English language arts and literature and foreign language. And so some schools have experimented with separate classes for boys in those subject areas. But you can't make a blanket statement that they would be as effective for everybody as single-sex schools are. It really depends on the individual students and on the individual needs. But I'd like to address a couple of issues that Wendy Kaminer raised,
please,
I could.
Sure.
One of them being VMI.
This is Virginia Military Institute,
I guess. The Military Institute case, where the mm-hmm. Supreme Court struck down the all-male admissions policy of VMI. Mm-hmm. The VMI folks were making these broad overgeneralizations and these same arguments, not about boys and girls. They were making them about men and women. What we're talking about are boys and girls who are still in the process of maturing and developing. And maturing, some of them maturing and developing at different rates than others are. So that's a very different argument you're making when you're talking about adults and when you're talking about children in their developmental stages. And when you're talking about disadvantaged children in particular and the kind of social climate that they have to survive in.
So you want to argue that age makes a difference and setting makes a difference?
Absolutely.
I think age probably does make a difference, but it still remains that we have no good, consistent, hard data that shows that there are consistent benefits to either boys or girls from single-sex education at the elementary school or at the secondary school level. And, in fact, sometimes what these schools do is to rely on stereotyping, so that in a chemistry class, for example, the girls will be taught to clean up after themselves much more than the boys will, because they'll be taught to act like little homemakers.
So that can happen, but we can't assume that it will happen.
Well, it does happen. I mean, I'm quoting something from a study that somebody did not that long ago, the way these schools operate. There are a number of feminists, for example, who don't like single-sex education for boys. They only like it for girls because they think there are a lot of unhealthy things that go on in all-male environments. It seems to me, however, that at the end of the day, most of the children in this country are going to end up in public co-ed schools. And that's where we ought to be focusing our efforts, to make sure that those public co-ed schools treat kids of each sex fairly, give them all the opportunities they need to succeed. And I think it's kind of a non-argument to say, well, rich people can choose to send their kids to private single-sex schools, so poor people ought to be able to do it as well. The fact that rich people do things doesn't make it a good idea. Rich people have coming out parties for their daughters, and I don't think that's ever really been a very good idea.
We've got a lot of callers, Wendy Kaminer, Rosemary Solomon, who want to join us here. Let's bring them in. Jillian is on the line. Welcome, Jillian. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to say that actually I experienced the effectiveness of separating boys and girls as a teacher. I was teaching English overseas.
And where?
In Central Asia.
Okay.
And I had a group of very, very energetic 7th to 11th graders in the former Soviet system. Basically.
And these were separated, boys and girls separated?
No, they were mixed initially according to their English levels. But I found that the boys were such clowns. And
so did you separate them?
That I finally said to the principal, listen, for the second half, I'd like to separate the boys and the girls, and I think they'll be able to learn better.
And did it work in your mini experiment?
It worked. It definitely helped the girls in my situation, because instead of being distracted by the boys, they could focus on their learning. In the case of the boys, I also had to deal with a broad spectrum of ages, and the 11th grade boys were showing off for the sake of the benefit of the 7th and 8th grade boys, you know.
Jillian, we're running out of time coming to the break here. I want to take your example and thank you for it and turn it to Wendy Kaminer. Wendy, here's, you know, again, a teacher in a classroom here in the former Soviet Union who says this helped diffuse some of the tension in the classroom and led to better education.
And if you gave me a day or two, I could probably come up with a teacher who said that she found a way to successfully deal with the dynamics between girls and boys in a co-ed classroom and that it worked best for everybody.
So your fundamental point is we're ducking the big issue here, because most classrooms aren't going to be single-sex.
My fundamental point is that single-sex schools discriminate on the basis of sex, and we should not be publicly funding public institutions that engage in discrimination on the basis of sex or race unless we have very strong empirical evidence that it's absolutely necessary in order to improve their education. And it seems to me that the burden of proof is on the people who are supporting discriminatory sex-segregated education, not the people who are opposing it.
Wendy Kaminer, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Wendy Kaminer is senior correspondent at the American Prospect. We're talking about single-sex schools. The Bush administration would like to see more of them. Should the federal government be clearing the way for single-sex schools? Should single-sex schools be an option for communities struggling to educate their kids? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about single-sex schools. The Bush administration would like to see more of them around the country. Question is, should the federal government be clearing the way for single-sex schools, changing the way Title IX is enforced to make it possible? Do you believe young men and young women will get a better education if they get a separate education? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I want to welcome Miriam Zoni. She's a senior at the Young Women's Leadership School in Harlem. Next year, she'll attend Columbia University. She's had a single-sex education. Good evening and welcome, Miriam Zoni.
Thank you very much. Hi, how are you?
We're real well. Thank you for being with us.
Miriam,
how many years did you spend in a single-sex education environment, girls only?
I have been in the Young Women's Leadership School for 6 years, so I've been in a single-sex. My elementary school, I was in co-ed, and then I moved on to single-sex education.
We've heard arguments pro and con tonight. What's your experience as a young woman who's had 6 years in a girls-only school and now going to Columbia? Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Well, I personally love the Young Women's Leadership School. I feel that it has been a success, and the fact that last year's graduation rate was 100%, and this year is also expecting to be 100%, I think that in itself shows that it is a success.
But do you think it's working because you don't have boys there?
Yes, I do. I feel that being in a single-sex environment takes away from a lot of the pressures that other students might experience at co-ed schools. At the same time, the fact that there's small classrooms and intimate school discussion-based learning, small student-to-teacher ratio, I feel that we know each other better, and that helps us improve our weaknesses and build our strengths.
And Miriam Zoni, what do you think of the fact, I guess, that the single-sex school initiative is kind of being pushed at inner-city minority populations? Is that a welcome thing, an offensive thing? What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's a welcoming thing, but at the same time, I just feel that single-sex education, it's not for every girl, and it's not.
Who's it for?
I think it's for girls that specifically want to go there, and I think it's a choice, and I think the opportunity should just be available for those girls that want to attend a single-sex school.
Well, if George Bush has his way, it will be. Miriam Zoni, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
No problem. Thank you.
We want to bring in some callers. They've been patiently waiting. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure.
In regards to the discussion tonight, my concern is, when you have a single-sex girl, the social maturity of whatever side is reduced. I speak from personal experience. My wife went to single-sex school.
You found her sexually immature, Mike?
Not sexually, socially.
Socially,
immature.
All right. Excuse me.
My apologies.
And did she feel the same way, that she'd missed out on something that was important?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In hindsight, she agrees. And when she went to college, she was an 18-year-old girl with the social abilities of maybe a 13, 14-year-old. And that made her an easy target for the more mature boys at her school, which she found out. And then,
Mike, that is an interesting point. Let me put it to Rosemary Solomon, and thank you for your call. What about this issue of socialization? Mike says his wife was an easy target when she went to college. There's all of life waiting with boys and men, of course, together with women. Might we get a little bit higher scores, but less ability to deal with the co-educational reality of life?
Well, that really depends on the individual child. I went to a single-sex high school as well, and certainly girls in single-sex schools, some will tell you, well, the absence of boys socially doesn't matter because they see boys after school. And I've asked this question in school after school that I visited. They see boys after school. They see boys in their neighborhood. They're more focused on the academics. That's what's important to them.
But they still get that exposure.
They have a whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. To deal with boys and men. And there are certain social drawbacks to it, certainly. But for me, on balance, and for me personally, having gone to a very academically rigorous single-sex girls' school, that was a defining moment for my life, and I know that for certain.
Let's get one more call in if we can. Ilan is on the line. Welcome, Ilan. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I have a simple question. Thanks very much for letting me ask.
Sure.
They're making it sound, or this is a question for the proponents of this, like there would be an option. You know, if you want your kid to attend, it's okay. But it seems to me like we already don't have enough money for the inner city schools. So, you know, some people might end up in these segregated schools that don't want to be there.
And who's going to put down the money to build the extra school to make it gender segregated? Thanks. It's a good question, Ilan. Let me put that to you. Lewis Gordon, are you there on that?
Sure. That was the main point I was trying to address when the question of comparison with those who have access to private education was raised. One of the difficulties is how we formulate questions of equality around questions of options. Now, in many ways, if we put it in straw men or absolutist terms, where it has to be all or nothing, we're going to have some very clear problems with these arguments. What's interesting about many of these schools is that there are a lot of things tied to certain levels of results. For instance, there's an allocation of more resources. There are other things tied to the testing mechanisms.
But Ilan says, who's going to pay for these separate schools?
Well, that's the point. What we have to do is to find a way to conjoin the question of sex-based education to other issues of material conditions, questions, for instance, what capital resources, questions of teacher training and other things. The idea that this will be a panacea to social evils would be ridiculous to begin with.
Sure.
But it's pretty clear that at least one issue, at least what I noticed what Wright and
Benjamin Salomon,
was
principle.
was bringing up was the question of discipline, and discipline when it is around the question of the interaction of boys and girls. He did not make the argument that if the discipline issue was around something else, mm-hmm. that same-sex education is going to deal with that. And in many ways, what I've seen from the discussion is not the view that this has to be policy overall, but that there should be at least places through which these can emerge where these students could, whether it be by busing or other resources, have access to them. And we have to also deal in the discussion with the question of to what extent are we going to begin to allocate funds to the very pressing social needs of our society rather than the ongoing moving of funds away from those. So all of these together play the role, again, back to this question of options. There seems to be an agreement in the argument that that options of some kind should be available.
And clearly that's the word that the Bush administration embraces. Rosemary Sullivan, we've just got 40 seconds left, but what's your prediction? It looks like this is going to happen. Look out 5 or 10 years. Will we see a lot more single-sex schools around the United States?
I'm not certain we'll see a lot more single-sex schools. I think in the United States, co-education will always be the norm, and there always will be some discomfort among some segment of the population with separating boys and girls. But we will see various kinds of programs beginning to flourish and really develop the kind of educational research that the naysayers are expecting at this point.
Mm-hmm. And they're waiting for that evidence. Our time is up, but we thank you for coming on with us tonight, Rosemary Salomon.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Rosemary Salomon is law professor at St. John's University and author of the forthcoming book, Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, British Foreign Minister Jack Straw speaks out on U.S.-European relations. This is On Point. Today is officially Europe Day on the continent. It marks the first steps taken in 1950 toward the creation of the European Union. With policy differences over the Middle East crisis, the International Criminal Court, and trade disputes, some say there is a widening rift between the United States and the EU. British Foreign Minister Jack Straw was in Washington yesterday. He told an audience at the Brookings Institution that these differences in policy do not need to lead to a parting of ways. Here's an excerpt from that speech.
The great alliance between the democracies of America and Europe is more vital than ever it has been. We have friends and allies all around the world, but for more than half a century, Europe and America have stood together as a rock of stability, of order, and of freedom. The transatlantic alliance is an essential relationship on which our freedoms are built. Now, we may differ from time to time about our priorities, but we do not differ on the values we share and the freedom which we defend together. And we shouldn't set ourselves a standard by which we have to agree on everything. As free-thinking democracies, we cannot and should not do that. But we do agree on what really matters, and we ought to be, therefore, more relaxed on those issues about which we differ. Now, there are, in fact, plenty of differences with our European partners inside the European Union. But so what? The idea that we will always agree on everything with our European allies is simply ludicrous. Yet when differences arise between Europe and the United States, as there are on matters like climate change, steel, and the scope of international controls through the Biological Weapons Convention or the International Criminal Court, we seem much more worried about the effect of these on the fundamentals of the mutual relationship. In my judgment, we should not be. In truth, relations between European countries and the US, as within Europe, have long been replete with differences. And what should define a successful relationship is not, in my view, the synthetic insinuation that there are no differences, but the way in which these differences come to be resolved. We are mature enough to cope with dissent and debate. We both recognise the fundamental commonality of our roots and values. America came to Europe's aid twice in 25 years, and then stood by Europe for another 45 years as it struggled with the consequences of Soviet totalitarianism. Equally, the immediate reaction to the attacks on your country on September the 11th was the same as if our own territories had been attacked. NATO alone should not be expected to carry the entire weight of the transatlantic relationship. We have to attend to the US-EU relationship more widely. Disputes like steel attract millions of column inches, but they tend to conceal a deeper reality, which is of a growth of trade and economic interdependence between the US and the European Union. The EU and the US need to work more vigorously to promote international trade, which is in both continents' interest. What matters is not the process, but the outcome. The EU is only a means to an end, and that end consists of security and prosperity. Now, there is no contradiction between being pro-American and being pro-European. I reject the idea that relations with the United States and the European Union involve some zero sum, that an individual has to prove his pro-European credentials by being anti-American. The truth is that all European nations have ties of family, friendship and culture with the United States, which are often as close as those which we enjoy each with the other European nation. And within Europe, we have learned in recent decades the value of working closely with one another, of maximising our agreement and minimising our differences. In my judgment, we in Europe should conduct our relations with the United States on the same terms, for our fundamental interests are the same. We have everything to gain from a continuing a robust confidence and a confident partnership in the future. The Atlantic Alliance has endured because it is founded not just on interests, but above all on values. And while the world may change, the fundamental values which have bound us together for half a century have not changed. Our unshakable faith in democracy and the rule of law is the foundation not only of our freedom, but also of our security and prosperity. There will be debate and there will be differences of approach, yet neither will undermine an enduring alliance of enduring values.
That was British Foreign Minister Jack Straw speaking yesterday in Washington. You can listen to the entire speech on our website at onpointradio.org. Lewis Gordon, he's saying we should be more relaxed, that the Atlantic Alliance is a bulwark for stability, order, and freedom. We should be relaxed about the points of contention. But the points of contention sound pretty grand scale, too. Global climate change, global control of bioweapons, trade battles, international justice. These are not penny ante issues.
Indeed. In fact, what struck me is the underlying anxiety in the speech. The anxiety seems to also carry with it a desire to maintain a unilateral economic relationship with the rest of the world on global issues. In many ways, the separation of North-South relations, the situation in which there'll be an us, mainly U.S. and Europe, who will benefit from this relationship seems to undergird this. Some of the other things concern me as well. Why can't we have, for instance, the same set of standards that we set up to set up our relationship with European nations apply to non-European nations? In many ways, these kind of relationships are maintaining a double standard. And to that, I should add this question about values. I mean, who says the values of which he speaks are uniquely Euro-American values? There are values that could be shared with other parts of the world. However,
so you don't find the cozy relationship of family, friendship, and culture so reassuring personally?
I don't really buy it. There's something also greater on the need. He speaks of democracy and freedom, but there's another set of values that we have to take very seriously. For instance, the growing racism in Europe and the impact of that in the rest of the world.
I also felt the tension in that speech. He's looking for areas of commonality, but he's clearly worried about the relationship. Lewis Gordon, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.